A government shutdown is looming Friday unless Congress and President Trump strike a deal on the so-called wall at the Mexican border. The immigrant issue continues to grab headlines. Senator Brian Schatz calls on the Defense Department to stop any misuse of taxpayer funds to build detention centers. And new details are being released surrounding the death of a 7-year-old Guatemalan child while in U.S. custody. Reports indicate the little girl, Jacqueline McQuinn, died of sepsis despite efforts to save her. The drama's unfolding only heightens the experience of a Honolulu attorney who volunteered this fall to help immigrant families seeking asylum. Renette Kawakami is a professor at the University of Hawaii who offered her services in the Texas town of Dilley, about 70 miles out of San Antonio. It's the largest family detention center, and Kawakami was part of a team of lawyers who assisted hundreds of immigrant families who had been separated at the border earlier this spring.
Thousands of attorneys, I think, were volunteering, but it's how do you manage that? So what the Dilley Project, pro bono project, had was that a project where you come in for a week with a team of other lawyers from all over the country, and the expectation was you either are fluent in Spanish or you have a Spanish interpreter with you or you have someone available by phone, which really, when you have someone who's translating by phone, it's just not the same. It's much, much more difficult than having someone in person. And you come in for a week from Sunday to Friday, and then you fly out, and another team comes in and helps take over. And what we're doing was mostly after the fact, after families were reunited. And now you have families who are in custody, continue to be in custody, and need to go through an asylum officer and have a basically what's called a credible fear or reasonable fear hearing. They're a little bit different. One is more stringent than the other. A credible fear is a lower standard. A reasonable fear is a higher standard. So what we were doing was helping these moms, these mothers who don't speak English, who are frightened and scared, and some were illiterate, some could not read or write, and helping them be able to communicate to an asylum officer the persecution that they feared back home, whatever country they came from. And that was our job. That's what we did from about probably 7 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning to 6:30 at night. And we were lucky because the week that we were there, there were fewer people coming in. A lot of people were being released, and they think it was anticipation of what they at that time was a caravan, because we were there at the end of October, early part of November.
And so when you hear all the stories that are in the news and knowing that you had this firsthand experience dealing with that, what are you thinking?
It's heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking to hear about it before we went. It was heartbreaking and soul-crushing to speak to help the asylum seekers, the women and their children. We interviewed children also. Some were teenagers, some were young as like 5 and 7 years old. And it was just very heartbreaking because it's real. It's not like they're making this stuff up. They are fleeing real persecution. They're not big bag criminals. They're women who are like shorter than I am, and I'm 5 feet tall. They're tiny women with tiny children, and they're frail and they're defenseless. And it was wonderful to feel that we made a difference and we helped these women and helped them able to get through their asylum hearings with the asylum officers, and it made all the difference for them. That was good.
So had you done this type of work before, or had this a similar experience like this?
So interestingly enough, I've never done any immigration work at all, never done any asylum work. I am a former public defender for 26 years, so I had experience with interviewing witnesses and clients and being able to be an advocate and how to help people in that way, but I've never done this kind of work. It would have been, of course, ideal that we were that if we were trained in immigration work. But what we did was I went through online training that the Dilley Project and the Immigration Council provided to all the volunteers. So I had been working on that since July and trying to prepare myself for these issues that I had not arisen in my practice before that. Andres Tobar, who is a third-year student who came with me as a translator and as an interpreter, and thank goodness he had experience in Argentina doing human rights work in Argentina. So he had already some facility with Spanish spoken in judicial terms or in law terms. So that was good that he had that experience. But he had already taken immigration class, so he had probably had more experience than I did in immigration work. But he was fabulous. He was really wonderful. I would not have been able to go had he not come with me.
And so was there any one particular story maybe that struck you of maybe the hundreds that you dealt with?
So it wasn't hundreds. It was probably about 10 or 12, but it took – that's how long it took. Every day we had to work so closely with them for hours. So we maybe saw two clients a day together with their families. Andres spent more time with more people because he had Spanish, because he was fluent in Spanish, he was able to speak to intake, so what they call charlas, and he was able to talk to multiple women, like probably a total of 100 to 200 women at a time, because that was the intake, like explaining to them, this is what's going to happen, this is what we are here for, we're here to help you, just be honest, and things like that, just going through the what to expect when they went to a hearing. So he did actually spend much more time with a bunch of people. He and I spent longer periods of time with individuals and their families. We only saw women with children. That's what we did.
So any one particular family that might have struck you?
It's interesting. They were all, I remember every single one. Their stories are profoundly sad. And I would say the one that probably struck me the most was a woman whose children, whose two daughters were being abused back in Honduras. And, of course, we can't tell you their names. There were no identifying information. One daughter was being sexually abused. The other was being physically abused. And they were basically being used as slaves. Hearing the two girls tell their story of what was happening to them was, I would say 26 years as a public defender prepared me for it, but I was still very moved and shocked. It's something that's going to stay with you forever. And I think that was true of many of the stories that we heard. That was one story. I think another one that was truly, truly, moving was a woman who was indigenous. So she belonged to an indigenous tribe, and that alone caused persecution in her homeland of Guatemala. And her son and her were separated. So they were a family that were separated back in April. They were reunited in July, but they still had not been released. By the time we got back, two Fridays later, we got the word that they had been released and pictures of them at the airport, and it was really heartwarming. This woman was not just persecuted because she was not a good Spanish speaker. Because she was indigenous, she spoke her own indigenous language, and that's what she was fluent in. She was also abused by her father. She had been beaten as a child to the extent that it caused her to be developmentally disabled.
Oh,
and
that's
so
sad.
That added to her difficulties, and both in elementary school, not being able to speak Spanish, not being able to learn Spanish any better. These are very simple, sweet, kind people, and you know it's a difficult process. What people don't understand is that the asylum process is not easy. So even though she may get past this portion where she's being released into the community, she still has a year to then file for full asylum, and that's a hard and difficult process. So what we did was we went through the form with her to help her apply and get the information that's necessary. And the form requires things like, within the last 5 years, where have you lived? Every place you lived. And then within the past 5 years, every place you've worked. And they want the addresses and the phone numbers and the names of your employers. And you're talking about someone who's spent all her life just working as a domestic person. So what she's been doing is cleaning other people's houses. So in a country where I ask her, well, what house? Where was the house located? And it's like, well, it's the house that it's the bottom of a hill near this kind of tree by the bus stop. And there's no address. So there's a town and there's sort of an area, but there's no address for this. And this is the kind of information we had to, you know, dig for and try call back to Guatemala and talk to her relatives to see if we could get more information. And some of that also was difficult because, you know, they're not really sure. Are we really there to help them? We try to tell them we are, and I think for the most part they believe us. But there's also a slight distrust, and they're worried about what's going to happen to their to their relatives back in Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador? If we call them, will they be on some kind of list, right? So it was that kind of those kinds of obstacles that we had to overcome. There were like attorneys. There were about 20 attorneys in our grouping from all over the country. There were people from Wisconsin, people from New Mexico. There was a group from the Bay Area. There were people from New York and New Jersey, and we were all together, all working together for the same, you know, good cause. And the very next week, another group comes in. I know there were people from BYU and people from Nevada that were also attorneys that were coming in to help.
So if there's anybody out there listening then is interested in this project,
It's called a Dilley Pro Bono Project. I think you can just Google it, and that's how I found out about it. And also through another Facebook group called Lawyers for Good Government, I found out about that there also. There's Raices, R-A-I-C-E-S. That's another group that they're in San Antonio. I believe they're in the paper or in the news. Part of it is because of their of what happened with a young girl that passed away in the United States government's custody. I think as long as we keep on holding families in custody, I think we're going to continue to need attorneys. And, you know, the difficulty, again, is that you need to be fluent in Spanish or Portuguese, because the majority of the asylum seekers are Spanish-speaking. I think what's really heartwarming is that at one point when I was in Dilley and I was in the facility and I wanted to go forward with another interview, and Andres was busy, and I made calls and emails back home, and instantly I had at least 7 people willing to call in and help and translate, and that was really wonderful. And I recall someone saying that, gee, where they were from, they didn't get that kind of help so immediate and so quickly. And that's the thing about the Aloha spirit, right? People are willing to step in and help out even though they're 5,000, 7,000 miles away.
Well, Renette, thank you. Thanks for sharing the story.
You're very welcome. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
That was UH Law Professor Ronette Kawakami talking about her pro bono experience helping immigrant families seeking asylum from places like Guatemala and Honduras.